In our study tonight, we're just winding up, of course, the 12th chapter, and I hate to have to leave a chapter when we only like one verse covering the chapter, and that's what we did, and especially when that verse is the last verse of the book. But we ran out of time in our last study, and we were talking about the time of the end in the 12th chapter, and we were talking about events that pertain to the time of the end, and the sealing up, and then the revelation of the things that Daniel is talking about that would be perceived by those of New Testament times. Now, as we identify the time of the end, what is the writer talking about? We discussed that through the chapter. And even into the 11th chapter, we've noted that stated a time or two. Randy, what is the time of the end that's referred to here?
Time of the end is the end of Jerusalem.
All right, the end of the destruction or the end of Jerusalem as it would be destroyed. We looked at this in our study last time to try to figure out these numbers. Now, I don't simply mean to reiterate this, but it helps us, I think, to get before us the things that are being discussed, especially at the end of this chapter. The 1,290 days that are mentioned in Daniel 12, verse 11, and the 1,335 days that's mentioned in verse 12, separated by 45 days, just in the reading of the text. And I want to read that again for our benefit tonight. In verse 11 it says, "And from the time of the continual burnt offering shall be taken away, and the abomination that maketh desolate set up. There shall be 1,290 days. Blessed is he that waiteth, and cometh to the 1,335 days. But go thy way till the end be, for thou shalt rest, and shalt stand in thy lot at the end of the days." In these verses, we see these numbers, and no doubt complex numbers as far as I'm concerned. In my study, I spent a great deal of time trying to identify these numbers and come to some conclusion or reconciliation concerning these 45 days. The best that I've been able to come up with is what you see on the board, but it helps us, I think, to see a starting point. Now, Terry and I were talking last Wednesday night that sometimes there are those who shift this over just a little bit, but they begin at a different starting point, generally at AD 67 when the Roman army besieged the city of Jerusalem. But backing it up to AD 66, the abomination of desolation standing in the holy place. Authorities tell us that the date on that was November AD 66. Josephus varies just a little bit on that. Roman authorities approach the city of Jerusalem and then withdraw, as we see in these passages indicated the time when the those who were faithful to God would be given the privilege to escape unto the mountains. And of course they were to pray that it would not be in the wintertime. They were to pray that it would not be on the Sabbath day, and they were to pray that women would not be with child. It would make it much more difficult for them to escape. But all that being said, if we start here at this date, about AD 66, we wind up over here at the time and half a time, as it were, at AD 70. And then when we add this 45 days to it, the conclusion that I've come to is that it's the space between the time when the sacrifices would cease and the time when Jerusalem was completely burned and everything was over. But that sets the stage, I think, for the things that we're talking about in our concluding statement in verse 13. We're talking about those things that pertain to the destruction of the city of Jerusalem. Now, in verse 13, as again it talks about the end of the days, "But go thou thy way till the end be." These things would not happen during Daniel's lifetime. I think we've studied previously, I forget which chapter it was, that talked about those things occurring long after Daniel would be passed away and down in the far distant future from the days of Daniel. And so the things were not completely revealed to Daniel in a way that Daniel understood all of the complexities of the things that were given to him. But yet we see that Daniel would not live to see these events fulfilled, but yet he would rest in death. "Go thy way," the writer says in verse 13, "till the end be, for thou shalt rest, and shalt stand in thy lot at the end of the days." Now, I'm not sure, I was talking with Glendale a little bit about this, "stand in thy lot at the end of the days." Whether that's indicating that Daniel would be standing in a righteous state or a righteous lot at the end of the days, that is, when he would die and the destruction of Jerusalem would ultimately come, Or if it's talking about Daniel would rise at the end or rise from the dead and receive his eternal inheritance. Either one of these sounds plausible to me, but at any rate, you can decide which one sounds the most plausible in the context. Randy?
I'm not sure I understand the difference between
the two. Well, the difference in the two was that Daniel would stand in his lot at the end of the days, the difference in the two being the time element. At the end of the days, Daniel would stand with the righteous when the city of Jerusalem would be conquered. Or Daniel would stand with the righteous when the righteous are raised from the dead ultimately at the second coming of the Lord. The difference being in the time element, both of them would be true. You're still frowning at me.
Well, I don't understand how it would be true that he would rise again at the destruction of Jerusalem.
Well, no, that wouldn't have application. Yeah, let's look at it. But go thou thy way till the end be, for thou shalt rest and shall stand in thy lot at the end of the days. That yours reads differently.
New American Standard says, but as for you, go your way to the end, and you will enter into rest and rise again for your allotted portion at the end of the days.
Well, that sounds like this then.
Again is in italics, but rest and rise is not.
Yeah.
So enter into rest and rise for your allotted portion at the end of the days.
Okay. That sounds like what I have on the board. Yeah, okay. All right. Now what I wanted to do tonight is to go back to Daniel chapter 1 and review a little bit, because admittedly this has been a difficult study. How many of you think that this has been a difficult study? Several of you think that this has been a difficult study. Now, if we can go back just a little bit and hopefully see how far we can go in reviewing some of the things that we have learned. I've titled this portion of our study, The Final Outline of Daniel, because I've had a number of outlines. And so I've called this one The Final Outline of Daniel, and it may be adjusted a little bit as we go on just a bit. But God's providence in history. Now, there's been one or maybe two major points that we've tried to make in this book. The overall point is that God rules in the kingdoms of men. We haven't missed that, and we're going to repeat that several times as we go through the various chapters in a state of review. But two points that we've tried to make in the study. One is past, or I should say present, and then future. Those things that Daniel is writing about that pertain to him, to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, the lion's den, and so forth that happened to Daniel himself. And then those things beginning in chapter 7 that's pointing to history that would be recorded in the future. And those things, of course, have presented the most difficulty in our study from chapter 7 on through chapter 12. But in our study tonight, in the first chapter, we see that Daniel is determined to remain pure. The context of Daniel chapter 1, what's being dealt with in the context? I said to Richard and I think Glendale, I was going to ask a lot of questions tonight, so you feel free to speak up. What's the overall context of Daniel chapter 1? What has taken place that's caused Daniel to take a stand on some things? Randy, sets the stage for the whole book.
They were taken captive.
All right. Daniel and some of the young men, the folks from Judea, have been taken captive. Taken captive by Babylon, and in particular King Nebuchadnezzar. And the king has authorized the what's his name? Starts with an A.
Ashpenaz, verse 3.
All right, thank you. Ashpenaz, verse 3. To have the responsibility of preparing these young men for service in his kingdom. And Daniel and the young men, the youths among the young captives, are instructed to do what? That Daniel is opposed to. All right, eat the king's meat. And Daniel is not willing to do that. Why? All right, likelihood it's contrary to the Jewish diet as was required by the Old Testament law. And of course, we also notice in verse 7 that these young men are given Babylonian names. In verse 8 it says, but Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the king's dainties. Randy, the New American Standard Translation uses another term for that.
The king's choice food and the wine.
All right, the king's choice food. I like that. It's simpler, perhaps more in tune with how we speak today. But in verse 9, God made Daniel to find kindness and compassion in the sight of the prince of the eunuchs. What is it that the prince of the eunuchs allows Daniel and these young Hebrews to do? All right, to eat vegetables. That is, to eat those things that were in harmony with the diet that was prescribed for them. Now, because of their faithfulness, what does God do for them? Verses 17 through verse 21. All right, gives them strength and knowledge, understanding. The ability to interpret dreams, okay, better than all the magicians and enchanters that were in his realm. So we see that the faithfulness of these young men resulted in God awarding them. Before I pursue with the second chapter, any questions on this brief outline of the first chapter? Any comments further on it? I think the first chapter is pretty simple to read and to understand. In the second chapter, it begins in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar dreamed dreams. Now, the dreams that King Nebuchadnezzar dreamed, what were they? What was it that he has dreamed and he wants someone to explain it to him? What did he dream, Randy? Don't look at me unless you expect to be called on. It's on down a little further in the text. All right, down about verse 31. What did he dream?
Dreamed about a great statue which was large and displayed over. Just read it.
If you'd like.
Sure. 31. Daniel 2:31. You, the king, were looking, and behold, there was a single great statue. That statue, which was large and extraordinary splendor, was standing in front of you, and its appearance was awesome. The head of that statue was made of fine gold, its breast and its arms of silver, its belly and its thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, and its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. You continued looking until the stone was cut out without hands, and it struck the statue on its feet of iron and clay and crushed them. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold were all crushed at the same time and became like chaff from the summer threshing floors, and the wind carried them away so that not a trace of them was found. The stone that struck the statue became a great mountain and filled the whole earth.
All right, here's what Nebuchadnezzar saw. But Daniel is the one that tells Nebuchadnezzar what he saw. What arrangement did King Nebuchadnezzar want from the enchanters, soothsayers, magicians that were in Babylon?
He wanted them to tell him the dream without him saying what it was, and then also to interpret it.
All right, now why did he want that? All right.
And he said, "Oh, that's too hard. No one can do that."
All right. And of course, the penalty was, if they did not do that, was
death.
All right.
And this is the chapter that introduced the rest of the chapter, the kingdoms that they're going to deal with. This has all of them laid out.
All right. And this becomes a very important outline, essentially, for the rest of the book.
Right. It helps you understand. You know, a lot of people try to get this, they try to get that. If you go all the way back to Daniel 2, you see this. Present day or future kingdoms are coming. Because I read again this week several, they have it. Hitler, they have it. Hussein, they have it everywhere.
All over the board.
You go right back to chapter 2, it shows you those kingdoms.
The sequence of kings, yes. We're going to look at that in just a little bit, but the problem with these diviners of the Chaldeans was what? They couldn't explain the dream. Their attitude was, you tell us what you dreamed, and then we'll explain the interpretation of the dream. Well, the point being, they couldn't do either because they were in somewhat of a fix, as it were. But they were saved by the young captives. Look at verse 12 through verse 16. Randy, would you mind to read for me again?
Sure. Daniel 2:12 through 16?
Yes, sir.
Because of this, the king became indignant and very furious and gave orders to destroy all the wise men. So the decree went forth that the wise men should be slain, and they looked for Daniel and his friends to kill them. Then Daniel replied with discretion and discernment to Arioch, the captain of the king's bodyguard, who had gone forth to slay the wise men of Babylon. And he said to Arioch, the king's commander, "For what reason is the decree from the king so urgent?" And Arioch informed Daniel about it. So Daniel went in and requested of the king that he would give him time in order that he might declare the interpretation of the king.
So Daniel, in his request of the king, essentially saved the lives of the magicians and enchanters and soothsayers of the Chaldeans. And we're going to see that they're not quite as kind to Daniel in just a little bit when we get over to about the sixth chapter. But continuing further into the dream that King Nebuchadnezzar had, we see the king's dream is revealed. Randy, you read it in verses 31 through verse 35. But the interpretation of the dream, David, is becoming the focus of the, in fact, the book of Daniel. It sets the outline upon which the rest of the book of Daniel essentially hangs. And as we read in the concluding few verses, or several verses, of the second chapter, you'll notice beginning at verse 36 through verse 39 that the writer is identifying kingdoms, physical kingdoms of this earth. And he begins with Nebuchadnezzar. Look at verse 38. I want to begin reading at verse 36. There's a point in verse 37 I want to emphasize. But it says, "This is the dream, and we will tell the interpretation thereof before the king. Thou, O king, art king of kings, unto whom the God of heaven hath given the kingdom, the power, and the strength, and the glory." Let's pause right there. We've talked about a number of times what the theme of the book of Daniel is. What is it? God rules in the kingdoms of men. Even the kingdom over which Nebuchadnezzar rules has been given to him. Nebuchadnezzar has been brought to that place and for a purpose. Turning back, if you will, to the second chapter, beginning at verse 21. Daniel, as he praises God at verse 21, he says, "And he changeth the times and the seasons. He removeth kings and setteth up kings. He giveth wisdom unto the wise and knowledge to them that have understanding. He revealeth the deep and secret things. He knoweth what is in the darkness, and in the light dwelleth, or the light dwelleth with him. I thank thee and praise thee, O thou God." Now, Daniel recognizes that whatever information he has, it came from God. Whatever information Nebuchadnezzar has received in this vision came from God. And Daniel recognizes and tells Nebuchadnezzar, "The point to which you have arrived has been given to you by God. God rules in the kingdoms of men." And then at verse 38, "And wheresoever the children of men dwell, the beast of the field and the birds of the heaven hath he given into thy hand, and hath made thee to rule over them all. Thou art the head of gold." Now wherever, David, you start in history, you have to start with Nebuchadnezzar. You have to start there. That draws a definitive line that we're going to talk about in a later chapter. But it draws a definitive line where you must begin. Thou art the head of gold, David.
But like I say, we know the starting point. Even some of the people that I read that said, you know, Hitler and altered history, they, you know, would say, now some of them, but a lot of them would still have, you know, the Babylonians, Assyrians, the Persians, and then the Greeks that have all these. And they even said the Romans for the number one.
Yeah.
Even though later on they go all the way into modern history.
Yeah. And they take off on these 10 toes.
Yeah, and like I said, right here is your outline for it.
That's right. That's right. But you've got to start with Nebuchadnezzar, and when you end with the fourth kingdom, you've got to end with what the text says about the fourth kingdom. Instead of adding kingdoms to it. And I think that's the fundamental mistake that so many, in particular the premillennial teacher, makes in his understanding of this passage. But he describes four kingdoms. Thou art the head of gold, that is, the Babylonian Empire, ruled over by Nebuchadnezzar. And after thee shall arise another kingdom inferior to thee, and another third kingdom of brass, which shall bear rule over all the earth. And the fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron, for as much as iron breaketh in pieces and subdueth all things, and as iron that crusheth all these shall it break in pieces and crush. Now, let's pause there and notice what Nebuchadnezzar has seen. He has seen an image that depicts four kingdoms. The nature of the fourth kingdom is described how? Pardon me?
Mixed or divided.
It's mixed or divided, that's right. In verse 41 it says, "And whereas thou sawest the feet and toes, part of potter's clay and part of iron, it shall be a divided kingdom." What kingdom would be a divided kingdom? The last one, the fourth kingdom that he has just described. He said, "But there shall be in it the strength of the iron, for as much as thou sawest the iron mixed with miry clay." What kingdom is he still describing? The fourth kingdom. And then at verse 42, "And as the toes of the feet were part of iron and part of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly broken." Now, David, here's where some run away. This kingdom shall be what? Its nature would be a divided kingdom. When he talks about the toes, iron and clay, these are the same components that he's just been describing. He's not talking about separate kingdoms, but he's identifying the division that would take place within that kingdom. Now, Daniel tells Nebuchadnezzar not only about this fourth kingdom, but what is going to happen during the days of this fourth kingdom. Verse 44 and 45. Very important verses. We want to commit these to memory, if you would. Bruce? All right, "The God of heaven is going to set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, nor shall the sovereignty thereof be left to another people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these and stand forever." It's essential that we understand what these verses teach. In the days of the fourth kingdom, the God of heaven is going to set up a kingdom. How is the kingdom that God would set up going to be different from the kingdoms that have just been described? It'll never be destroyed. Now keep in mind, God rules in the kingdoms of men. The kingdoms of men will come and go, but the kingdom that God sets up will not go. It will be established by the God of heaven, and it will stand forever. Notice, if you will, the nature of it. It'll break in pieces and consume all others. Now, in the Hebrew letter, I want you to turn in your Bibles to Hebrews chapter 12 and look at verse 28. Hebrews chapter 12, verse 28. Bruce, you have that for me? Would you mind to read that, please?
"Therefore, receiving the kingdom that cannot be shaken, let us give grace whereby that we may offer service of well-pleasing God with reverence and with awe."
As you read Hebrews 12, verse 28, ask yourself the question, what is it that these Hebrews were becoming a part of? What's the nature of the kingdom that they entered? A spiritual kingdom. It cannot be shaken. It's one that will last. Now, the context of Hebrews chapter 12 is contrasting that which will stand to that which will not stand. In the Hebrew letter, what is it that they were a part of that would not stand? Pardon me, Carolyn, I think you said. All right, they were a part of the nation of Israel. That would not stand. We know that Jerusalem was to be destroyed and the nation of Israel as an entity would be no more. However, these Hebrews were becoming a part of something that's distinct from that. They were becoming a part of something which cannot be shaken. And of course, the implied question is, which would you rather be a part of? Do you want to go back and associate yourself with those things that shall be shaken? Or do you want to remain with those things which shall not be shaken? The greatness of what you have become a part of causes that which you have left to fade in the background. And so the question is a real question. And it's the kingdom, of course, and we want to draw that conclusion that Daniel was talking about. If not, then when the kingdom that Daniel is talking about, which will break in pieces and consume all others, what would ultimately happen when it comes up against the kingdom that those Hebrews were becoming a part of? How do you reconcile that? You've got a kingdom that's going to break in pieces all others and stand forever, and here's one over here that cannot be shaken. You see, the conclusion that you must come to as you examine these two passages is that the kingdom of Hebrews 12, verse 28, is the kingdom that Daniel was speaking of in Daniel chapter 2, verses 44 and 45. Now, if you've got that nailed down, then that shoots a big hole in these premillennial theories or these theories such as Hitler or Saddam Hussein or something way down the pipe. because those Hebrews were becoming a part of the kingdom that had the identical nature of that which Daniel prophesied. Now that's important. Does everybody see that? Everybody in the class see that? It's essential that we see that. Richard? Well, essentially, that's so. Question or comment? No? Okay. Okay. All right. How does the king then respond to the things that Daniel has told him? Okay, Annette? He's shaken by them. That's true. In verse 46, the king fell upon his face and worshiped Daniel and commanded that they should offer an oblation and sweet odors unto him. And the king answered unto Daniel and said, "Of a truth, your God is the God of gods and Lord of kings and a revealer of secrets, seeing thou hast been able to reveal this secret." Now again, we want to emphasize the theme of the book. God rules in the kingdoms of men. As long as Nebuchadnezzar recognizes that, he's in good shape. But when he fails to continue on that vein, he gets in a rather bad shape. Randy?
It's just another example of purpose of miracles.
Yes.
Confirm the word.
That's right.
And this confirmed that Daniel was Daniel had God behind him.
That's right.
It confirmed it. I mean, if you just stop and think about it, if you had any kind of dream and you asked somebody what it was and they told you exactly what the dream was,
you would be impressed.
You'd be pretty impressed.
Yes. All right. Bruce and then Glendale. Well, now that's true. That's true. But he praises the God of Daniel and exalts him.
He also said the God of gods, and so he still thinks there's a lot of gods.
That's right.
These gods are there. This God's better than my God.
Yeah, yeah. Glendale?
When the discussion on miracles, when Jesus was approached by the demon, Nicodemus made a notable statement that he knew that Jesus was of God, so no man can do these miracles except he be of God.
That's right. So that exalts. Very important statement, yes. So Nebuchadnezzar comes to the conclusion that there's no king greater than God. That is the God that Daniel worships and serves. Now what does that say about Nebuchadnezzar? As great as King Nebuchadnezzar thought he was, he believed that the God of Daniel is greater. Indeed, God rules in the kingdoms of men. And Nebuchadnezzar is catching on to that idea, but as we said, he doesn't continue to hold on to it. Let's move on just a little. David, go ahead.
You got a lot of kings at this time who declare themselves God.
Yes.
So he's recognizing that he's still, even if he says that, he's still not in the kingdom.
That's right. Absolutely right. In the third chapter, we read of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. But something happens. The king, Nebuchadnezzar, has made a decree. What is the decree? Jonathan?
That all these instruments and noises, everybody should fall down before this old statue.
All right, and what happens with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? They refuse to do it, and somebody reports them to the king. And when they're reported to the king calls them in and wants to know, is it a purpose that you do this? And how does Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego respond?
They said, yep.
On purpose, yes. I find it interesting the answer that they give unto Nebuchadnezzar in verse 16, in the middle of the verse. It says, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer thee in this matter. If it be so, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of thy hand, O king. But if not, be it known unto thee, O king, that we will not serve thy gods, nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up. And these verses, we see an expression of conviction. We will not do what you want us to do. We will not do what you've commanded us to do. Now there's all kinds of reasoning that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego could have employed. They could have said, well, it's the command of the king. And you know, we're supposed to obey the law, right? No, that won't work, will it? They could have said, well, he has authority over us. We're captives, so we must do what he says. No, that won't work either. They could have reasoned and rationalized a lot of things. But they just said, no, we won't do that. Oh, yeah. I hadn't thought of that, but that's right.
They've got a new God here. Nebuchadnezzar created it with the golden image, kind of like in Isaiah, where it talks about calling out the wood and stuff, the same wood that you heat and put the food around and all that. But right here is the birth of a new God that Nebuchadnezzar created. But he's still not that God is the only God.
That's right. He's going to learn that, though, before long. He's going to pick up some thoughts on that. Joey?
The fact that they take a stand and they don't compromise and say, no, we're not going to rationalize and say we must obey this guy because he has authority over the Father. The fact that they, you know, insisted upon taking that stand reminds me of the passage in the New Testament where they said, you judge whether or not we should obey God or obey man. And they were told to no longer preach in the name of Jesus. And they basically said, no, can't do it.
All right.
So the bottom line is we are supposed to obey the rulers of the land as long as that doesn't conflict with obeying God, because if you have to choose between the two, you have to obey God.
Got to put God first. That's right. Roy?
Is this thing part of the word? What we just read? Those three guys were just set in charge of a certain deal, and then now the king puts these requests on them.
That's right.
This is in order?
Yeah, this is in order. Yes. Well, yeah.
We just don't know.
Okay. But we still kind of have...
But certainly after.
The after, yeah. Okay. All right. Glendale?
Going back to Abednego, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they defied the king's order. And it goes along with what was said in the back there. Well, even the apostles said we ought to obey God, but the man was never commanded not to speak in his name. And they were beaten. And then they ceased not to preach Jesus in the temple daily.
That's right. Conviction.
They didn't cow down to political correctness, but they did what God said. So
that's right.
We need to also obey God rather than man.
That's right. And we need to obey God even rather than self. Sometimes it's our attitude just to compromise because it's easier. Or maybe we're looking for something that's easier. And these men certainly could have found it a lot easier to bow down before the image that King Nebuchadnezzar set up. But they weren't interested in that. We will not, they declare. And so we see conviction expressed on behalf of these people.
Well, if you go back to that statement, you know, that we talked about where he said, your God is the God of God. You see that, you know, like he had to understand that God was powerful, but you also see he still has that misconcept. So you see where he's, you know, here in this verse, now he's, he said, well, you know, I recognize your God was king, but you need to help me out and recognize my God. It's kind of a compromise. They're not going to do it.
No, they will not. Randy?
They had a very strong faith. If you go back to Daniel 1, verse 17, He's asked for these 4 years. God gave him knowledge and intelligence in every branch of literature and wisdom. Fear of God is the beginning of wisdom.
True.
These are wise men. And when he told them to worship a different God, they knew perfectly well. We don't have to do what you say.
That's right.
You know, we have a bigger boss than you.
That's right. Now, how did this all play out? This is something we've talked about, but in review. How does this all play out? What happened in verses 19 through 25?
They get thrown in the oven from the furnace.
All right, they get thrown in the oven, in the fiery furnace. And then what happens to them?
They're not harmed.
Not even a hair of their head is singed because of the fire.
And as a matter of fact, the guy that was in charge of the whole thing said that as he looked into the fire, he saw another person in there with him.
All right. Very good. And how does the king react? All right. Well, in this instance, he wants them to be harmed. But afterward...
Oh, that's what the lion...
Yeah, you're thinking of the king in the lion's den with Daniel. That's right. All right, he says, crank up the fire. He wants them to be harmed in this particular instance, but that's a very loose paraphrase, but it gets the point, I think. Well, what happens? How does the king react to what has taken place with the fiery furnace? David?
Then he goes ahead and blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach.
All right.
Then he sees he's not in charge.
He's not in charge. God rules in the kingdoms of men. Now, he's beginning to get this idea, but he's still not got it nailed down. And he's got to learn this. Carolyn?
From this and from the earlier dream instance when he promotes Daniel, you get the idea that he's really saying, wow, your God is really great. Let's get you on my team. I could use a God like that on my team.
Rather than,
I need to worship this guy.
Okay. Yeah, that's a loose paraphrase too, but it kind of nails the point.
He was looking at it from a personal advantage point of view rather than a humbleness, where he would humble himself to God.
That's right.
God on his side, so he'd be on my team, and so I would be on, and that would be great.
That's right. He's going, it's coming. Yeah, it's coming. So the king makes a concession in the last few verses of this chapter. As we go on just a little bit further, we see that Nebuchadnezzar has another dream, and he has some problems as a result of some of these things. What dream does he then have in verses 1 through 18? Bruce?
I just wanted to say something before, because King Nebuchadnezzar realizes that there's no other God that can deliver like their God.
All right. He's having a hard time with it, isn't he? All right. It's quite contrasting to what he has previously understood about the nature of gods, and I'll use that term in quotation marks, quite distinct from what he has previously understood. What does he dream in the fourth chapter? Chris? All right. The vision of the great tree. And what was the significance of it? Anyone? He was the tree. And what's the interpretation of him being the tree? What's going to happen?
He's going to be brought down to a lower level, but it says it's going to leave the stump there. He's still going to have his place until he recognizes that, verse 26, that heaven rules or God rules.
All right.
He's going to be humble to recognize that.
All right. Let's notice a couple of passages. One is found in verse 17. The sentence is by the decree of the watchers and the demand by the word of the holy ones to the intent that the living may know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdoms of men. Here again we see the theme of the book underscored. And then over in verse 25, beginning in the first of the verse, it says, "And thou shalt be driven from men, and thy dwelling shall be with the beast of the field, and thou shalt be made to eat grass as oxen, and shall be wet with the dew of heaven, and seven times shall pass over thee, till thou know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdoms of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will." Yes?
Question.
Well, at verse 13, it says, "And I saw in the visions of my head upon my bed, and behold, a watcher and a holy one came down from heaven." So in this vision, it would seem a heavenly being that came down and cut the tree.
Is a watcher in this context an angel, or is the watcher some other?
I think so. Yeah, and this, keep in mind, is a vision or a dream that he's seen. So we want to put it in that context. Okay, any other comments or questions?
Well, now we know that he didn't humble himself, but God humbled him.
That's exactly right. His day is coming, isn't it? Richard?
I was going to say, we've discussed several times here about the fact that Nebuchadnezzar did not acknowledge Jehovah God as the one and only God. And we see twice here, verses 8 and 9, where Nebuchadnezzar is actually writing this portion of the book. And he says that he called, that Daniel came in before him. He says, according to the name of my God, that's Daniel's name. And in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. And then in verse 9, he says, I know that the spirit of the holy gods is in thee. Mm-hmm. So even though God has shown him through Daniel, he just can't believe it.
No, he hasn't caught on to it yet, but he's about to get the notion. All right. And in verse 32, we read of the king being a bit deranged, as it was. It says, "And thou shalt be driven from men, and thy dwelling shall be with the beast of the field, and thou shalt be made to eat grass as oxen. And seven times shall pass over thee until thou know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men and giveth it to whomsoever he will. And the same hour was the thing fulfilled upon Nebuchadnezzar. And he was driven from men and did eat grass as oxen, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven, till his hair was grown like eagle's feathers and his nails like bird's claws." In verse 34, at the middle of the verse, it says, "And I bless the Most High, and I praised and honored him that liveth forever, for his dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom from generation to generations." Is Nebuchadnezzar kind of beginning to get the notion here that there is one? It's kind of beginning to settle into his mind that there is one. And of course, he was deranged until he finally... Are we out of time already? He was out of his mind until he finally surrendered and lifted up his eyes unto heaven. In verse 36, it says, "At the same time mine understanding returned unto me, and for the glory of my kingdom, my majesty and brightness returned unto me, and my counselors and my lords sought unto me, and I was established in my kingdom, and excellent greatness was added to me. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven, for all his works are truth, and his ways justice, and those that walk in pride he is able to abase." Nebuchadnezzar's getting the message, isn't he? That those who walk in pride, God is able to bring them down. What is it that he's learning? God rules in the kingdoms of men. Even in his own kingdom, it was not because of his greatness that he had become king. It was because that God had brought him to that position. But his kingdom would ultimately fail. It would fall. And he's learning that God rules in the kingdoms of men. Is he seeing a difference between the gods of the nations and the one true God? Okay, Randy?
He learned the lesson that Daniel tried to tell him way back in chapter 2. He said, "You, O King, are the King of Kings, to whom the God of heaven has given the kingdom."
Mm-hmm.
Now he's learning firsthand.
He's beginning to get the notion. He's learned it. Yes. David?
Now, even in more subtle forms, today, reading the book of James, that we often say we're going to be here or there tomorrow. We may not be in a position of authority like Nebuchadnezzar, but we boast.
All right. He rules, doesn't he? He rules in the kingdoms of men. And I think in troubled times we need to be reminded of that. God still rules in the kingdoms of men. If you'd open your New Testament to, I believe it's 1 Timothy chapter 2. Yes. Verse 2. As the writer is talking about prayer, and he says at verse 1, I extol or exhort, therefore, first of all, that supplications, prayers, intercessions, thanksgivings be made for all men, for kings and all that are in high place, that we may lead a tranquil and quiet life in all godliness and gravity. Now, in our study of the book of Daniel, up through the first six chapters, we see God's providence in history. Do you see any place for God's providence in the present? We'll look again at 1 Timothy chapter 2. Yeah, why pray if God has no presence in the affairs of men today? If God has no presence in the affairs of nations today, then why bother praying for kings that we might lead a quiet and a tranquil life? Be no point in it, would there? Some have said that in time past, God intervened in the kingdoms of men, but now that the scheme of redemption is accomplished, He just backs off and lets things spin till they run down. I deny that. Why would there be any place for prayer?
In verse 37, he admits that he had a problem with
prayer. Yes, sir.
And it cost him.
Yes, sir.
And he learned the lesson the hard way. He could have learned the lesson, like Randy said, the easy way, but he didn't. He learned the lesson the hard way. And this also serves as a warning for us today to be humble and to not make the same sort of mistake as your personal life with pride.
That's right. Many New Testament passages identify the folly of that. There's one in 1 Peter chapter 5 at verse 6. He says, humble yourselves therefore under the mighty hand of God, that He may exalt you in due time, casting all your anxiety upon Him, because He careth for you. Humble yourselves before the Almighty God. And Nebuchadnezzar's learned that. He's kind of caught on to that. Now his son continues to have a problem with that.
Jesus reiterates that lesson of the parable about don't go into the chamber and sit in the highest seat.
All right.
And be asked to move down, rather choose the lower seat, and if there's a change, you'll be asked to move up, if you will, and therefore be glorified by God. So don't assume the top position. Assume the lower position, and then let God, if He chooses, exalt you into a higher position. Don't
All right.
exalt yourself and then have God be forced to lower you into a lower position.
God can do that. He can do that. I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe one of you pointed out in chapter 2, at verse 37, that Daniel has told, was that you, Randy? That Daniel told Nebuchadnezzar that the place that he has was given to him of God. Okay? And now God has humbled him. All right, we'll stop there. Yeah, I know. Randy's got the singing, and I'll do the invitation. So we got it. Oh, okay. As long as we got it covered. But Randy volunteered earlier. It was so nice of you to volunteer, Randy.